Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower, and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell, Jill Robbins, Ann Ball, and Brian Lynn. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, here is John Russell.
Animals rule the countryside at the Animal Paradise Sanctuary, 75 kilometers outside Argentina's capital, Buenos Aires. The sanctuary is a labor of love, something being operated for pleasure, not for profit. Gabriela Bezerik and Armando Scopa have been heading the center for over 25 years. They rescue animals that would otherwise have been killed for meat. Around 850 animals live in the sanctuary. These residents include ducks, pigs, and horses. The sanctuary is also home to llamas and capybaras, large mammals native to South America. Bezerik hopes one day to expand the animal paradise. I always say that I am going to save all the animals that are at risk of death, she told the Reuters news agency. Bezerik and Scopa, who are a married couple, support animal rights. Their ideas stand out in a country where meat consumption is central to the culture and to the economy. Yamila Buboff volunteers at the sanctuary. The animal paradise is the product of the work of two visionaries who a long time ago believed in giving a second chance to animals, mostly those destined for consumption, she said, so that they can be treated as the sentient beings they are, and not just as a plate of food. An economic crisis has held up some of the couple's plans for expansion. They are now looking for financial supporters. The important thing is that our paradise can keep going, said Bezerik. Everything I do is for the animals, and I want to continue so that this remains for them. As he fed Wolf, one of the sanctuary's horses, Scopa said that he sometimes worried about the future. He and Bezerik are now in their 70s. There are no heirs here. The animals are the only ones to inherit it, he said. The animals own the place. I'm John Russell.
A new study on people who eat red meat has found they have higher risks of heart disease and early death. The finding goes against other recent research that suggested removing meat from one's diet has few health benefits. The two opposing findings can make it difficult for people to make sense of what can seem to be conflicting messages on food, noted Dwayne Miller. He is a dietitian at Aston University in England. Miller was not directly involved with either study. But he and other researchers say that after examining research on the subject, moderation may be the best way forward. In this case, eating moderate amounts of meat, including red meat, is likely to be safe, Miller said. He noted the cost of producing meat on the environment, as well as the health effects of eating meat. However, in the interest of sustainability as well as health, reducing meat intake to the recommended less than 70 grams per day would be sensible. A researcher with ties to the meat industry published a report on the subject in September 2019. That report said people should not reduce the amount of red meat they eat. Some experts criticized the findings because they were in conflict with dietary advice from international agencies. The latest research comes from scientists at Cornell University and Northwestern University in the United States. Their findings appeared on Monday in the publication JAMA Internal Medicine. The scientists found that eating 2 servings a week of red meat, processed meat, or poultry was linked to a 3% to 7% higher risk of heart disease. They also reported that eating 2 servings a week of red meat or processed meat, but not poultry or fish, was linked to a 3% higher risk of all causes of death. Norina Allen was a co-leader of the latest study. She said the health risk is small, but people should try to change their diet. It's a small difference, but it's worth trying to reduce red meat and processed meat. She added that eating red meat is also regularly linked to other health problems like cancer. Allen is an associate professor of preventive medicine at Northwestern. The World Cancer Research Fund says red and processed meat may cause cancer. It advises eating only moderate amounts of red meat with an upper limit of 500 grams cooked weight per week and little, if any, processed meat. A group of experts writing in The Lancet in January suggested an ideal diet for human health and the planet. They said on average, adults should reduce the amount of meat they eat by 50%, and they should eat twice as much nuts, fruits, vegetables, and beans. I'm Jill Robbins.
Mobile phones have changed the way we communicate, but people disagree on whether the devices are useful tools for education. Students can be easily distracted by their phones during class. Are they listening to the teacher or texting their friends? Are they taking a picture of a quiz to cheat? Maybe they are playing a game or watching a video instead of paying attention. School officials, teachers, and parents are all trying to find out the best way to supervise students' use of mobile or cell phones.
In the Canadian province of Ontario, officials are restricting phone use during teaching time. However, there are exceptions for classroom activities, health, and other emergencies. France passed a law in 2018 banning the use of cell phones in schools for students up to age 15, the age when they go to high school. Last July, California Governor Gavin Newsom signed a new law. It says state public and charter schools can ban students from using smartphones in class and at school. It does not, however, say schools are required to completely ban the devices. The law asks school districts, charter schools, and education offices to develop cell phone policies to prevent or limit students' use of the devices at school. There are exceptions, which include emergencies or issues related to health and well-being.
One high school in California's Silicon Valley area had a serious problem with students and their cell phones. Joanne Soblich, a French teacher, said students using their phones in class had been a real problem. They were checking their phones and texting, going on social media, she said, and she would have to take the phone over and over and over. The school's vice principal, Adam Gelb, said some students were spending as much as 11 or 12 hours a day on their phones. So the administration turned to technology for answers. San Mateo High School now locks up cell phones during the day in a special container. Each student must put their phone away in a small bag with a magnetic lock. It is called a yonder pouch.
At the end of the day, students unlock the bag with another device. The bag is being used in schools in both the United States and Europe. The cost for the equipment is around $20,000 a year for a school, or $12 for each student. Teacher Joanne Soblich is happy. She sees a difference in students' behavior. She said they are very engaged this year, instead of just looking at their phones.
Other schools are choosing simpler answers to the problem. They ban cell phones in classrooms. One of these schools is Forest Hills School District near Grand Rapids, Michigan. School officials decided this school year to ban cell phones throughout the day, including at lunch. Dan Beam is the superintendent of the district. He told the publication Education Week the reason why district officials put the ban in place. They wanted to provide a clean break for students and not have the frenetic energy that can happen if kids start texting each other or social media posts start going, Beam said. They tried the ban last year as a test. Beam said they found that students said they were less anxious when they were not so attached to their devices.
Education Week found that more than 30 schools, and in some cases school districts, have put in place some kind of restrictions during the current or last school year. Districts across the country also have their own versions of phone restrictions, both formal or informal. One district choosing not to ban cell phones is St. Mary's Area School District in the state of Pennsylvania. Brian Toth is the superintendent of the small rural district. He told VOA, each teacher can decide whether and when to restrict students' cell phone use.
Toth said students have grown up with cell phones, and it is our responsibility to teach them proper use for tools within the classroom. He added that schools are teaching about cell phones and how to use them with social media and the internet. It is part of changing education for kids, he said, as long as we teach them to use them responsibly. The technology is here, Toth said. Schools should use it to help students and not fear it. I'm Ann Ball.
And I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. Larry West and Tony Riggs continue the story of President Woodrow Wilson.
In 1917, Europe was at war. It was the conflict known as World War I. After 3 years of fighting, Europe's lands were filled with the sights and sounds of death. But still, the armies of the Allies and the Central Powers continued to fight. The United States had tried to keep out of the European conflict. It declared its neutrality. In the end, however, neutrality was impossible. Germany was facing starvation because of a British naval blockade. To break the blockade, German submarines attacked any ship that sailed to Europe. That included ships from neutral nations, like the United States. The German submarines sank several American ships. Many innocent people were killed.
German submarine attacks finally forced the United States into the war. It joined the Allies, Britain, France, and Russia. Like most Americans, President Wilson did not want war, but he had no choice. Sadly, he asked Congress for a declaration of war. Congress approved the declaration on April 6, 1917. It was not long before American soldiers reached the European continent. They marched in a parade through the streets of Paris. The people of France gave them a wild welcome. They cheered the young Americans. They threw flowers at the soldiers and kissed them.
The Americans marched to the burial place of the Marquis de Lafayette. Lafayette was the French military leader who had come to America's aid during its war of independence from Britain. The United States wanted to repay France for its help more than 100 years earlier. An American army officer made a speech at the tomb. He said, "Lafayette, we are here."
And so the Americans were there. They were ready to fight in the bloodiest war the world had ever known. Week by week, more American troops arrived. By October 1917, the American army in Europe totaled 100,000 men. The leader of that army was General John J. Pershing. Pershing's forces were not sent directly into battle. Instead, they spent time training, building bases, and preparing supplies. Then, a small group was sent to the border between Switzerland and Germany. The Americans fought a short but bitter battle there against German forces. The Germans knew the American soldiers had not fought before. They tried to frighten the Americans by waving their knives and guns in a fierce attack. The Americans surprised the Germans. They stood and fought back successfully.
Full American participation in the fighting did not come for several months. It came only after another event took place. That event changed the war and the history of the 20th century. It was the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia. Its leader was Vladimir Lenin. The Russian Revolution began in the spring of 1917. The people of that country were tired of fighting Germany, and they were tired of their ruler, Tsar Nicholas. The Tsar was overthrown. A temporary government was established. It was headed by Alexander Kerensky. President Woodrow Wilson sent a team of American officials to Russia to help Kerensky's new government. The officials urged Russia to remain in the war.
Under Kerensky, Russia did keep fighting, but it continued to suffer terrible losses. Many Russians demanded an end to the war. Lenin saw this opposition as a way to gain control of the government. So he went to the city of Petrograd. There, he led the opposition to the war and to Kerensky. Night after night, he spoke to big crowds. "What do you get from war?" he shouted. "Only wounds, hunger, and death." Lenin promised peace under Bolshevik communism. Within a few months, he won control of the Petrograd Soviet. That was an organization of workers and soldiers.
Kerensky's government continued to do badly in the war. More and more Russian soldiers lost hope. Many fled the army. Others stayed, but they refused to fight. The end came in November 1917. Soldiers in Petrograd turned against Kerensky. Lenin ordered them to rebel, and he took control of the government within 48 hours. Russia was now a communist nation. As promised, Lenin called for peace. So Russia signed its own peace treaty with Germany. The treaty forced Russia to pay a high price for its part in the war. It had to give up a third of its farmland, half of its industry, and 90% of its coal mines. It also lost a third of its population. Still, it did not have real peace with Germany.
The treaty between Russia and Germany had a powerful influence on the military situation in the rest of Europe. Now, Germany no longer had to fight an enemy on two fronts. Its eastern border was quiet suddenly. It could aim all its forces against Britain, France, and the other allies on its western border. Germany had suffered terrible losses during 4 years of war. Many of its soldiers had been killed. And many of its civilians had come close to starving because of the British naval blockade. Yet, Germany's leaders still hoped to win. They decided to launch a major attack. They knew they had to act quickly before the United States could send more troops to help the Allies.
German military leaders decided to break through the long battle line that divided most of Central Europe. They planned to strike first at the north end of the line. British troops held that area. The Germans would push the British off the continent and back across the English Channel. Then they would turn all their strength on France. When France was defeated, Germany would be victorious. The campaign opened in March 1918. German forces attacked British soldiers near Amiens, France. The Germans had 6,000 pieces of artillery. The British troops fought hard, but could not stop the Germans. They were pushed back 50 kilometers. The attack stopped for about a week.
Then the Germans struck again. This time, their target was Ypres, Belgium. The second attack was so successful, it seemed the Germans might push the British all the way back to the sea. The British commander, Field Marshal Douglas Haig, ordered his men not to withdraw. Haig said, "There is no other course open to us but to fight it out." The British fought hard and stopped the attack. Losses on both sides were extremely high. Yet the Germans continued with their plan.
Their next attack was northeast of Paris in May. This time they broke the Allied line easily and rushed toward Paris. The German army chief, General Erich Ludendorff, tried to capture the French capital without waiting to strengthen his forces. He got close enough to shell the city. The French government prepared to flee. Allied military leaders rushed more troops to the area. The new force included two big groups of American Marines.
The heaviest fighting was outside Paris at a place called Belleau Wood. The American Marines were advised to prepare for a possible withdrawal. One Marine said, "Withdrawal? We just got here." The Marines resisted as the Germans attacked Allied lines in Belleau Wood again and again. Then they attacked the German lines. The battle for Belleau Wood lasted 3 weeks. It was the most serious German offensive of the war. The Germans lost.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.